We last spoke with the guest this hour a couple of years ago when he released the book, How the States Got Their Shapes. And now we talk with him about How the States Got Their Shapes, too. And it picks off where How the States Got Their Shapes leaves off. It explores American history through the lens of its state lines. But this time it looks at the people who created the shapes, and the stories are fascinating. Our guest is Mark Stein. Mark is a playwright and a screenwriter. His plays have been performed off-Broadway and at theaters all over the country. His films include House Sitter with Steve Martin and Goldie Hawn. He has taught writing and drama at American University and Catholic University, and he went to school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So here's our phone number as we explore these stories, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. And Mark, it's nice to have you on the air again.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's always great to be back in Wisconsin for me, even if it's via the airwaves.
You went to school in Madison, right?
I went to Wisconsin. My wife is from Milwaukee. My older son went to Madison and now works for Senator Cole. And my younger son is in Madison as we speak.
Well, all right. I love these Wisconsin connections. Tell us the story of how the second book came out. It's an interesting story. You hadn't really thought of this particular angle. Somebody suggested it.
That's true, right. When the first book did so well, I was invited to submit an idea for a second book. This really isn't my background, nonfiction, and I had a great deal of trouble coming up with an idea. I called a friend of mine, Mark Olshaker, who has a number of best-selling nonfiction books, and said, hey, could we have lunch? Maybe talk this over? And he said, yeah, sure. Or how about this? The people. You talk about people in that first book. Make that your second book. And that's the second book. We had lunch, but the discussion was closed.
So, I wondered if you had lunch when I read that.
Yes, yes. And I paid the check.
As well you should have, Mark. It was a really good idea.
Yes.
The stories are absolutely fascinating. We just don't know these stories at all. If you don't mind, let's start with a guy we all know pretty well. Who would have had a lot of our states named, and they would have been some of them similar to what we have now, and a few of the ones that went through, and some didn't. Thomas Jefferson.
Jefferson is fascinating. After the Revolution, Congress commissioned Jefferson to come up with a report detailing how do we create new states. It's not in the Constitution, and he did that. One of the things he then did was to propose what the boundaries would be for states west of the Appalachian Mountains and east of the Mississippi River, which was our western border at the time. Basically, it's a bunch of little rectangles, many of them with rather strange names. And, of course, one can see we didn't end up doing what Jefferson wanted. One thing that intrigued me, because we hear so much today about strength and the vision of the Founding Fathers, was when did Congress stray from the vision of this Founding Father? And the answer, I believe it was 3 days after he handed in his report. They already started tinkering with it. But two things kind of larger significance. One is that what Congress ended up doing in that region can be considered the biggest gerrymander in American history, although the issues aren't issues today. The number of states between the Appalachians and the Mississippi. So we're talking about the Midwest, and then we're talking about Alabama, Mississippi, Kentucky, Tennessee, is far fewer than the number of states east of the Appalachians, the 13 colonies plus Vermont plus Maine plus eventually Florida. What that meant was that control of the Senate remained in the east. So the treaties, which have to be ratified by the Senate, the eastern states could maintain that. And it was important because the Mississippi back then was either Spanish or French, usually Spanish. So they gerrymandered it so that relations with Spain would still be controlled by the eastern states. The other point is that if you look at the map, just even in one's mind, one can see sort of rectangular shapes emerging further west. And without going through all the steps in the process, that is Jefferson resurfacing through a congressman named Samuel Vinton, who kind of reminded Congress when Iowa became a state about Jefferson's vision, although the template became quite different, much larger than Jefferson imagined.
Now, who knows that information? It's just something we don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah.
And now some of the names, though, he had this idea of this neoclassical construction for the names, and they're kind of beautiful.
Yes, yes. I'm trying to remember them myself now. There was Illinoisiana, I think, or Michigania.
Yes.
And some of them were like Ellipsopotamia or something like that. I'm leafing through my own book as we speak. Here we go. Illinois, that came back, but he had Sylvania. Some of these are hard to pronounce. Chironosius, Pelipsia, Polypotamia. What's interesting, though, is they are neoclassical sounding, even the ones that came back, Michigania,
yes.
Illinois. And when I saw that, although it doesn't have to do with state lines, I thought about how after the Revolution, and Wisconsin is a good example of this, too, also where I live, Washington, D.C., state capitals and in Washington, all federal buildings followed a neoclassical architecture. They didn't use the Gothic or Georgian architecture of the British. There were all these subtle changes after the Revolution. In terms of state lines, the big one was that while the monarchs, it simply wasn't on their screen to create colonies that were equal. Not because they were evil, it just wasn't on their screen. So if it behooved them to create a little colony called Rhode Island to relieve a political problem in Massachusetts, they did it. Congress struggled, not always successfully, to create states equal, I want to say more equal in resources necessarily than size, but if they could also in size. One other change was that the monarchs named a lot of their colonies after people. Pennsylvania, the Carolinas are after Charles, Georgia after King George, Maryland is after a princess, and so forth. Congress would repeatedly refuse proposed names that were after people, with one exception, which tells you something about the mindset in the 19th century, and that's the state of Washington, which, by the way, was one of the proposed names of Thomas Jefferson, to bring it back to his proposal.
The one line, and we're way off on our thinking about this, that we all know about and we associate it deeply with slavery is the Mason-Dixon line.
Yes.
You talk about it being America's most famous and misunderstood line. How so?
Well, it has nothing to do with slavery, or it didn't when it was surveyed. There were conflicting documents that created Maryland, Pennsylvania, and Delaware. And a long, long negotiation ensued. And when they finally agreed what would be the boundaries, just to make sure they didn't have to revisit this anymore, they brought over they didn't want to use an American surveyor. That person could be accused of prejudice on this. They brought over two of the finest scientists in England, Charles Mason, Jeremiah Dixon. Getting those guys to be surveyors, to survey a line, it's sort of like getting Mozart to play at the prom. This was in 1763. The line is actually, as you mentioned, it's really three segments. There's Pennsylvania-Maryland boundary. Then it goes vertical, separating Maryland and Delaware, and then again horizontal on the eastern shore, separating Maryland and Delaware. I got interested in when it started to be used as a shorthand for free states and slave states. And what happened was after the Louisiana Purchase in 1803, Congress had to decide about slavery in the Louisiana Purchase. Henry Clay came up with the Missouri Compromise. It established a line, 36 degrees, 30 minutes. That's the southern boundary of Missouri. It's also, by the way, the northern boundary of Texas, the top of the panhandle. And below that line, you could have slavery. Above it, no, in the new states and territories, with the exception of Missouri. Well, once that was established, the idea of a line, I started to find it in 1824. It probably came up a little sooner in Congress, where Congressman John Randolph said, those of us who are unfortunate as to live below Mason and Dixon's line, blah, 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 blah. So that they simply kind of took that notion of a line. Technically, there was slavery even then above the Mason-Dixon line. Delaware goes above it with that semicircle. What is now West Virginia, but then at the time was Virginia, goes above it, where it kind of points up between Ohio and Pennsylvania. And really, it hadn't been fully abolished in a number of the northern states. New Hampshire didn't abolish it until after the Civil War.
You mentioned Delaware, and you asked the question that will be the question of the day. Why do we have Delaware?
Yes. And answer it in this new book, because it did fascinate me. A man named Augustine Herman, back in the colonial era, is the key player there. We have Delaware because when the Dutch, we think of the Dutch in New York, but back in the colonial era, but actually the Dutch settlements extended all the way from what is now Delaware up through eastern Pennsylvania along the Delaware River and then into New Jersey and New York and a little bit to parts of Massachusetts. After the Dutch authorities were ousted, they were very concerned down in what is now Delaware because technically they could become part of Maryland. That was a Catholic colony. They thought this could be all kinds of problems. And their point man, appointed by Peter Stuyvesant up in Manhattan, was this man, Augustine Herman, who was actually from Bohemia, also an area with a lot of boundary and ethnic problems. And he brought a kind of Bohemian approach to the problem. He didn't follow Stuyvesant's orders at all. He was much more ingratiating to Lord Baltimore. And end of story, he got Delaware kept separately, not because Lloyd Baltimore said, oh, you're such a nice guy, you can have it, but because he kind of maneuvered into a position where he could, without getting into the weeds, as my son would call it, he set up the legal notion that was later used to make the case for Delaware. But it was, in fact, finally, it was Dutch, and the Dutch wanted to be separate, and basically the British didn't want problems, so they said, we'll make you separate.
Mm. There's a ton of history in this book, in addition to fascinating characters, a ton of history.
Thank you. Mm. Yes, yeah. I'm just amazed. It was with the first book and with the second book, too, at how much was unearthed. But I'll tell you, with the second book, after my friend Mark Olshaker pointed me there, what really took it from that's an interesting idea to boy, am I passionate about this, was that what I discovered is that each of the people that are in this second book, none of them, I don't think anybody ever said as a kid, when I grow up, I want to establish a state line. they all had a quest, and the quests were different. And so what I write about in the second book is what was the quest of this person, excuse me, or that person, and how did that end up on the map? So that's really what fascinated me so much with the things like 49 different people that I look into.
Well, now that you're all grown up, though, Mark, do you want to establish a state line?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I thought you might.
And the state line I personally would like to establish is the state of New Columbia, but maybe we shouldn't get into D.C. voting rights and all that.
Oh, no, we will. Toward the end, we'll do that.
Okay.
We'll do that, because that's interesting, too, why it isn't. All right.
Yes.
Let's go to phone calls. Marty in Douglas County is our first caller for you. Hi, Marty.
Hello, good morning. I can't believe you have on a guest who can answer the question we've been asking for decades. How is it possible that Michigan has part of Wisconsin, probably a third of Wisconsin, and an island that is absolutely nowhere near it, closer to northern Minnesota than Michigan, Isle Royal and the UP of Michigan? How do they become part of Michigan?
Sure.
Is
okay.
My question.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Marty, I have the answer for you. Those are two separate events. The Isle Royal was in the treaty that ended the Revolution, I think it was actually Benjamin Franklin's participation in that, where he recognized there were mineral, I think it was copper, and he managed in the we give you this, you give us that sort of things to get that included in the United States. But the Upper Peninsula is a much more interesting story to me, and I share your pain about, you know, this really is part of Wisconsin. Come on.
Right, it is, yeah.
Oddly enough, it has to do with the southern border of Michigan, even though it's way up at the top. And when Ohio became a state, which was well before Michigan, it was in 1803, I believe is the year, they departed a little bit from the stipulations in the federal law in describing their northern border. It looks like, at first glance, the bottom of Michigan is a straight line, but if you notice, Ohio's side of that is a little bit angled. And they angled it to include the port at Toledo. And they did that actually because of the idea that the Erie Canal was going to be become a reality, and that would make the Great Lakes, not lakes, but major avenues of commerce. Well, it gets to be the 1830s, and Michigan comes along for approaching statehood, and they want that port. It's actually there are more canals or all kinds of other reasons, and they almost go to war with Ohio. It's called the Toledo War. And by almost go to war, I do mean that the militia of the territory of Michigan and the militia of the state of Ohio are face to face and on the verge of absolute warfare. The federal government at that point intervenes and says, in effect, to Michigan, hey, how about this? We'll give you this peninsula way up north there that belongs to we don't even know. So, you know, hasn't been created yet. There's nobody there except Indians or something. So, you know, will you take that and let Ohio just have its way? And again, I'm simplifying enormously. Michigan basically said, okay, we'll take the deal. So that's how Michigan's Upper Peninsula was taken from Wisconsin before Wisconsin existed because of a boundary dispute with Ohio.
Well, that's great. As a proud Ohioan, I grew up outside of Cleveland. It's nice to know I had somewhat
yes.
of a hand in that.
And if you're familiar with Lucas County, or the name Lucas County, Ohio, that is right in the heart of the disputed zone and named after the governor of Ohio, who in fact quarterbacked this conflict from Ohio's side.
Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
Thanks for the answer.
Thanks, Marty. Thanks for the call. We'll take more questions in a moment, more calls and emails. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Mark Stein is our guest. He is the author of How the States Got Their Shapes and Now How the States Got Their Shapes Too, The People Behind the Borderlines. Two more of your calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Scott.
Hey, as an old native-born Californian, I have a question that I keep hearing, and I'm assuming from your background you must have spent at least some time in the Golden State. And I keep hearing this, that we will soon be having our 51st state when they break California in half. And I guess since that seems so implausible, do you think that could ever actually happen? And if so, who'd be the person that you'd be writing about next about that little piece of work?
That part of it, Scott, I can't tell you who the person would be. Do I think it will happen? I get questions of that sort because there's some other places in the country that also talk about it. And I always want to say, no, it won't happen. And then anytime I look at a historical atlas, I realize that boundaries throughout history are always changing. But it makes me so uncomfortable. But finally, I'd have to say, you know, why would we be any different? There is currently a movement in, I'm going to call it Southern California. I don't think that one's going to go anywhere. There was a movement in the 1930s in Northern California, along with a part of Oregon, to create a separate state. That one ended on December 7th when they decided to stop fighting. But you still, California is special. It is so big, right from its outset. When they had their statehood convention, they debated four different shapes, but two of those four included a Northern California and a Southern California. At the time, the issue was to create a slave Southern California and a non-slave Northern California, and ultimately opted not to do it. And even afterwards, there was still a push for it to happen. So I couldn't predict. I wouldn't be terribly surprised. The one example we have from history where a state divided is the state of West Virginia, divided off from Virginia during the Civil War. The man who I write about with that is Francis Pierpont. And one factor that pertains to what you're talking about, Scott, is that Western – I'm talking about the original Virginia, the Virginia after the Revolution that included West Virginia. The western part was never happy. And in that respect, it sort of mirrors, I think, issues in California. There's some long-term, in some ways geographically rooted differences between North and South in that state. What's fascinating, now I'm moving a little bit away from your question, but about Francis Pierpont in West Virginia, very briefly, is that when Virginia seceded from the Union— they had a convention in Western Virginia, if you will, to say, well, they seceded from the Union. We will secede from Virginia.
Virginia.
And
wow.
Pierpont stood up in this convention. I supported the idea. And he said, well, we can't do that because the federal government said you can't secede from the Union. They're not going to recognize a state that has seceded from a state. And it was mayhem. I mean, they probably were ready to kill the guy. But he kind of, once calm was restored, said what we have to come up with is a way to secede based on the illegality of secession. Now, only an attorney could solve that riddle, but that is exactly what Francis Pierpont was. And he came up with an eye-popping legal tap dance that created West Virginia. As to California, who knows? You know, maybe an earthquake will separate it and we'll get our 51st state that way. I don't know.
Yeah. Where were you born, Scott?
Oh, I was born in Oakland, but growing up, you know, the way people would talk about it was that people in the northern part of the state resented all, you know, the Southern California and all its growth and sun-blessed population. And And the thing that bothered all of us in the North the most was that the Southern Californians didn't care. They were too busy going to the beach to worry about us resenting them. It's like, okay, just another happy Californian. Great guest. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go a little farther west because I found this story fascinating, too, in terms of there are two versions of the truth and what's the real truth here. Let's go to Hawaii where the queen wasn't real hot about making Hawaii a state. Can you talk about the controversy and tell us the truth about how it became a state?
Yes, the Hawaii was ruled by a monarchy up in the late 1800s. The queen, I believe it's pronounced, it was Liliuokalani, very educated, cultured woman. But by that point, power had gradually been increasingly shared with the wealthy white population. Initially, they came over as missionaries, but in time, sugar planters came. Essentially, there was here's the myth. The myth was that there was a revolution that then installed a democracy, a republic in Hawaii, and elected as its first president a man named Sanford Dole. But he actually is not the Dole pineapple. That's a cousin of his who came shortly thereafter and started planting and canning pineapples. But that is the connection to Dole pineapple. That's all true. Here's what is also true, that the constitution of this republic was structured in a way that if you were not a white male, you basically could hardly qualify to vote. Very few could qualify to vote. So the control was retained, much as in the South with the kind of restrictions on African Americans, was retained by this minority of white people. My chapter on Liliuokalani and Sanford Dole, I talk about how Dole actually wrote letters and consulted with a professor at Columbia University on how can we create a constitution that will assure that power will remain, he just outright said it, in the Teutonic people. The revolution was backed in some technical ways, if you will, by the presence of a U.S. battleship in the harbor and by the dispatch of Marines to maintain order. That was politically very controversial and almost reversed here in the United States. But, yeah, Hawaii was a great prize. Finally, was not. But that was that piece was incredibly controversial even then.
Hmm. Let's go to John in Eagle River. Hi, John.
Hey, how are you guys?
Fine. How are you, John?
Good. I bought a book at a rummage sale last summer. It's the Wilson's History of the United States, published in 1859. And it is amazing. And
I love those old books.
Yeah. I don't know if you know the first name of the United States. It was called Pascua, Florida. And because all actually Columbus and all those guys thought they'd discovered the East Indies.
Yes.
And so they sailed from Cuba to do different things, and they found, I think it was DeSoto, found Florida, and he found it on Easter Sunday. So he named all of the United States Pascua Florida,
interesting,
which is Easter flowered, in the Spanish. And interestingly enough, the first slavery that hit the U.S. was not slaves coming to the U.S., but slaves being brought from the U.S. to Europe. And they captured many Indians, put them in the hold. A lot of them died of just because they went on a hunger strike. But the slavery went the other way first, and it wasn't until years later that slaves came to the U.S. from Florida. So many fascinating things in this book that showed how fluid the history was, you know, from the 1400s is when this book starts, up to 1859. And just fascinating.
I didn't know that, but I love that kind of stuff. I encountered a sort of similar thing. Nevada, that bottom part of Nevada that comes down to a point. If you can imagine the line that is the bottom of Colorado and Utah, top of New Mexico and Arizona, that used to extend all the way to California, so that Arizona, it's probably hard to do with just in your mind, but Arizona used to have a pointed west. And that pointed west was later given to Nevada as its pointed south, if you will. One of the reasons I read was that it contained a fertile area, and it was known by the Spanish, who you know first found it as in Spanish as Las Vegas.
Right.
And so that's Las Vegas.
Another book I read talked about the Democrats being the predominant party in the South, the Republicans mm-hmm. being the predominant party in the North. They were mostly abolitionists. The Democrats were the slaveholders, and they got us into the war with Mexico as a way of expanding the Southern states so they'd have a majority in Congress, and they even wanted to go back to war against Mexico and conquer it all the way to Central America.
What you're saying is absolutely true, I believe, and it's actually, not to keep pushing my book too much, but there are several figures in my book who are part of what you're referring to. One that you've probably heard of is James Gadsden, who made the Gadsden Purchase. That's now sort of the little bottom of New Mexico and Arizona. But he wanted to purchase, and he was authorized by the United States to purchase a good deal more of Mexico. We had just finished a war with Mexico, and Santa Anna didn't want to sell us anything, but he was broke from the war. So he sold us just enough to raise enough money to provide his military to have defenses against the country he just sold the land to. So one is James Gadsden, who was a railroad president. Another is John Quitman, was the governor of Mississippi at the time. This is in the 1854, who had, I'm going to say secretly, but put quotes around it because it was covered in the press openly, plans to invade Cuba with a private army, totally illegal, by the way. That's why it was secret with quotes, to annex it to the United States as a slave state.
My.
Gadsden was also involved in that controversy, the issue in California, even after statehood of having a southern California. So there was this whole plan. During the Civil War, Arizona and New Mexico were not separate yet. It was all the New Mexico territory. The first state of Arizona was horizontal along the southern half of those what are now those two states, and it was the Confederate state of Arizona. Union Army rushed in and put an end to that. I talk about a whole theory I'm not remembering his name now, that a senator raised about this effort to create an extended southern slaveholding belt. Yeah.
Hmm.
I wonder if Kennedy knew that it was illegal to invade Cuba, and whether or not the first Arizona governor was as goofy as the present one.
Oh, well, thanks for pointing out, because I should have made clear. It was illegal to raise a private army to invade Cuba.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. A private army of Americans to invade another country. That was a new part of called the Neutrality Act. What Kennedy was up to, and before him Eisenhower with the Bay of Pigs, legally speaking, was a different situation.
The Bay of Pigs was planned up here in Lake Forest Golf Club by Eisenhower and his generals in 1859. Called the
about as good as his golf game, I guess.
the Operation Northwoods.
Hmm.
Fascinating. Thank you, John.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to use that, you can, talk@wpr.org. Mark Stein is our guest. His latest book is How the States Got Their Shapes 2, that is spelled T-O-O, but it could be also, as well, the people behind the borderlines. And we go to Doug in Mukwonago. Hi, Doug.
Hi.
Hi.
I just had a curious question, or a question about why, I think I know the answer. I think it was because of the New Madrid earthquake, but why parts of Illinois lie west of the Mississippi and parts of Missouri lie east of the Mississippi, and why, when it happened, didn't they just switch their parts and keep themselves all east or all west of the Mississippi?
Yeah, good question, Doug. It may have been the New Madrid earthquake down in that region of Illinois that changed the course of the river. But the standard is basically this: when rivers are used as a boundary, and then a state boundary, and then change their course, which happens more often than you know, Congress would like, the original line stands. And the Supreme Court has consistently upheld that. So, in fact, there are, particularly down in the Mississippi, because that's just notoriously fickle channel, any number of regions of Missouri that are really in Illinois, what appear to be Illinois and vice versa, there's an area in downtown Omaha, Nebraska, that is technically part of Iowa, because the Missouri River, during a tremendous flood, changed its channel. And then there's an area a little bit different, but in the bottom of Indiana that is actually Kentucky, not because the Ohio River changed course, but because Kentucky has the entire Ohio River in its boundary as opposed to the middle line. And there was an island very near Indiana that was therefore part of Kentucky, and it filled in to the mainland with silted up. So it's technically a part of Kentucky. But I think the court's reasoning, real quickly, is that, land has been deeded. People are paying taxes to a particular state. There is a kind of an inconvenience, but there's questions of constitutional questions regarding property and takings of property or, you know, I think it has to do with things like that, that once the land is deeded, the line, whether it's the river's changed or the line was inaccurately surveyed, once it's deeded, that line stands.
Illinois has a strange southern boundary, doesn't it? I grew up in Illinois, and the farther south you travel, the more you feel like you're entering the South.
And you are. Illinois was shaped in many ways by, of all things, the French and Indian War, where the French were ousted by the British and their American colonists. And so the Mississippi River, the western border of Illinois, and the Ohio River, the southern border of Illinois, became its boundary. But I'll tell you, there's what you're saying about being in the South has a lot to do with Wisconsin and why Illinois' northern border goes so far further north than, say, its sister state, Indiana. And that's because all the rivers in Illinois, with one exception, I believe, all ultimately flow to the Mississippi River. So the commerce, we're talking 1810, 1811, when this is really an issue, commerce all flows to the South. Illinois, although the slavery wasn't permitted in that region, was very much tied to the South in its commerce. The delegate that got statehood for Illinois was a man named Nathaniel Pope, and he's the one who got this border moved up. Originally, it was supposed to be the southern tip of Lake Michigan. Well, Congress had already showed they'd moved that up to give everybody a port because of the Erie Canal and so forth. But he didn't need 60 miles to get Chicago. By the way, the one river that went to Lake Michigan was the Chicago River, this rather small river. He didn't need 60 miles. So why did he get all this extra land? Nathaniel Pope, back in 1812 or something, already foresaw that there could be a national conflict over slavery. And he also saw that there was a contradiction in the law that said that when they become states, these Midwestern areas, they can't have slavery, but they'll be on full footing with the original 13 states. Well, the original 13 states got to decide about slavery. So they might challenge whether or not they could have slavery. And that worried him. He wanted that extra land because of the population it would bring. It wasn't a whole lot of population, but he wanted it because up further north, those were mining people. They were not pro-slavery people. They were not connected to the southern economy. Mm-hmm. Everybody else was connected to the southern economy. Lo and behold, when Illinois became a state, it immediately had a referendum to rewrite its constitution to allow slavery and to, in effect, challenge that contradiction. And the referendum for slavery lost by about 2,000 votes. And that was roughly the population of that extra land, that extra part of what we might want to call Wisconsin, that Nathaniel Pope got into Illinois. If Illinois had become a Confederate state, who knows? I think it was 250,000 men from Illinois served in the Civil War, some extraordinary number. I had to check it twice, and I may have just misquoted it. I hope I didn't. And had that been Confederate, I can't imagine the war having gone the way it did.
To say nothing of what would have happened to Abraham Lincoln, you know?
Maybe he just stayed in Kentucky. I don't know.
Right. And then what? I don't know.
Yeah.
Mark Stein is our guest. His book is How the States Got Their Shapes to the People Behind the Borderlines. More phone calls momentarily at 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next phone call, Paul in Duluth. Hi, Paul.
Hi. For your guest, I read your book, your first book, and I watched the television series, and it's just wonderful.
Thank you.
And this is right out of the news today. Earlier today, they were talking about Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, entering the presidential race. And it got brought up a couple of times that he had talked about Texas having the right to secede from the Union, and which it doesn't. But the other part of it was that one thing was that when Texas became a state, they were given the right to. Because of such a large landmass, they were given the right to divide into as many as six smaller states. And I wonder if you know how that all came about. And just on a personal note, if Texas were to secede from the Union, I'd be okay with it as long as they insisted on taking Oklahoma with them.
Mark.
Okay, well, there's a number of things there. I don't know enough about Rick Perry to know how much in jest or not he was. I think he regrets having said it, but I don't want to speak for him or get into that. What struck me when he made the remark was, does he know how that went for Texas when they were an independent republic? Because it financially did not go very well. They were a republic for, I believe it was 10 years, and they were so deeply in debt that when they became a state, to finally settle their debts, they sold a huge hunk of their western land to the United States to get the money to settle those debts from their independent days. I want to talk about that for just one quick moment because that was handled by Stephen A. Douglas, one of these people who we've all heard of and know very little. Certainly, I did when I started this. About what did he ever really do other than debate Lincoln? He established more state lines than any other single individual, and that one that he established when they bought the sunk area west of western Texas that they then gave to what is now New Mexico. So that whole kind of hunk out of the western part of Texas that's the eastern half of New Mexico, that was the land Texas sold. And Douglas I don't want to extend too much, but he located where that line would be. And I'll just say this. It is, in my view, the most brilliantly located line on the American map.
Really?
It ended up preserving for this population of Hispanics who had not sought to become Americans, did not speak our language. It ended up creating the baseline for future division of their New Mexico territory so that their center of their population, which was mostly along the Rio Grande that runs roughly through the middle of New Mexico, and particularly at Santa Fe, their largest settlement, a buffer between the Anglos in Texas and the Anglos moving into what's now Arizona. Santa Fe is 3 degrees from its eastern border and its western border of New Mexico. And at the same time, as it played out, New Mexico and Arizona are almost perfectly equal in size. That boundary, Douglas set, is 103 degrees west longitude. 103? Why not 100, Stephen? Because he really the man knew the map, and it's fascinating. And because of that security, I think it's one reason we don't have the kind of problem that up in Canada that they've inherited over the years with Quebecois and cultural.
Well, that's a fascinating story.
So that part one. You asked about the states. It was 5 states, not 6. I don't think Texas. I could never find anything on Texas ever even creating a plan. The South very much wanted them to do it. That's a lot of votes in the Senate from slave states. I don't think Texas. They were through too much. They had too much of a sense of who they were. So I don't think they ever pursued it. I just want to add one more thing, Paul. You're in Duluth. On Wisconsin Public Radio, you would have been in Wisconsin had the territory of Wisconsin remained what it was until this Erie Canal that I keep talking about. When the Erie Canal became a feasibility, every future state, and in one case, state, Pennsylvania, that was in the vicinity of the Great Lakes had its boundaries changed. Wisconsin had a number of them changed, and one of them was it used to follow the Mississippi River to its source. It was changed to follow the St. Croix and then a straight line up to the end of Lake Superior so that the future state to the west, Minnesota, could have its port on the Great Lakes. And that is exactly where you are today, Paul, Duluth, Minnesota, as opposed to Duluth, Wisconsin.
Oh, but Paul, we think of you as being a Wisconsin guy. We really do. Thank you for the call. We should probably mention, we were back on Texas for just a moment, Sam Houston,
yes.
Huge guy, huge state. What's his story?
His story is fascinating. fascinates me because it's such a staggering. I don't mean drunken, although he was a drinker actually. But I just kind of mean trying to follow the path of it from Virginia to Tennessee and then west and so forth, and it somehow led him. It seemed by fate to Texas, where his greatest renown is as really the foremost military leader in Texas independence. But Sam Houston, a couple just fascinating aspects, give some idea of the size of this man, in addition to the fact that he was, in fact, a big man. He ran away from home. His father died when he was young. He ran away from home when they were living I guess it would have been Tennessee at the time, and was taken up by the Cherokees, who had relocated into what is now Arkansas, and was actually adopted by a Cherokee chief, who later, after the War of 1812 and all, and Sam Houston had distinguished himself in that, he went with a Cherokee delegation to Washington to meet with the Secretary of State, John C. Calhoun. And Calhoun knew him, or knew of him, and he came to this meeting with the Secretary of State in full Indian regalia, did not please John C. Calhoun.
Oh, my.
He did the same thing again when Andrew Jackson, who had been the commander, I don't think he knew Houston in 1812, but had been the commanding general there. Jackson was the president, and he showed up again in a different capacity in Indian regalia. Jackson just laughed and slapped him on the back. He was the governor of Tennessee and had gotten married a little bit late in life. There was no one quite knows what happened, but the marriage ended very suddenly, and he resigned his position and went back. He went on a bender, is really what he went on in the wilderness. But he went back to his Indian father, who dried him out. And was the trip with Jackson where he shipped him forward again. Absolutely fascinating man. Absolutely fascinating.
Absolutely fascinating. Let's go back to D.C. I don't want to run out of time because we want you to have a chance to draw that line. That push for statehood continues, right? Doesn't it? It's still going on?
It does. I think that there's been a kind of strategic retreat to just kind of talk about voting rights. Your listeners may or may not know that the people who live in the District of Columbia can vote for the president, but they do not have voting representation in the House of Representatives or in the Senate, though they do pay taxes. It puzzles me that the Tea Party, Boston Tea Party was not about taxation. It was about taxation without representation.
Mm-hmm.
And I heartily endorse opposing that. I can't understand why the Tea Party's number one issue isn't voting rights for the District of Columbia. I write about Eleanor Holmes Norton in the book, who is the current person carrying the torch and a fascinating woman in her own right. But here's a couple of things that absolutely intrigued me. My first thought was, so when did this begin, this issue of whether or not people in the District of Columbia should, in fact, be able to have the voting representation? And I discovered it was during the writing of the Constitution. There actually are minutes of those meetings, and I quote from a confrontation between James Madison and particularly with Patrick Henry, where you can see it on the page. They are nose to nose about whether or not this is a just an American thing to do, to deny these people the rights. Madison said we have to do it so that we can protect this as our capital and not be subservient to local voters. And Patrick Henry saying this is as un-American a thing as I can imagine. And it has recurred through history periodically. James Monroe in his inaugural address, I mean, just all the way up to the present day. So it's not a new issue. One other misconception is that today it's conservatives, it's Republicans who oppose it, it's Democrats who want it. Absolutely not true. There have been times where the Democrats have controlled both houses of Congress and the White House. They have not done anything for it for reasons that had to do with that time and place in history. And there are some surprising Republicans who have come out, I'll say more narrowly, in support of the idea that you do not need to amend the Constitution. And most notably, to give D.C. voting rights, most notably Kenneth Starr, who headed the the inquiry into Clinton, gave testimony in Congress. It was like arguing before the Supreme Court, citing precedent after precedent of Supreme Court decisions that show that Congress need not amend the Constitution. So it's just stepping away from it as a resident of District Columbia and just kind of looking at it from the outside. It's a fascinating conflict that hasn't been resolved yet. But it's fascinating because it like the Mason-Dixon line, quite different than sort of the mythology about why D.C. Doesn't have it, who's for it, who's against it. So much mythology in that.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Mark, so much for writing the book and for being with us.
Thank you.
Mark Stein, the book is How the States Got Their Shapes Too, that's spelled T-O-O, The People Behind the Borderlines. We thank Mark for his time and really fascinating stories. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Look forward to seeing some of you at our Washington, D.C. reunion gathering in Toma, Wisconsin on Saturday. It should be fun. And we'll be back on the air on Monday at 9 with all things political. Thanks for listening, everybody. This is the Ideas Network.